He's on once a month, Charles R. Smith, one of the world's most uniquely qualified geopolitical military analysts and strategists, is here monthly. His website, software.net, a great place to go to try to keep tabs on who's got how many guns and bombs and who doesn't. And Charlie, welcome back to the program. Are you there, Charlie?
I'm here.
Okay. Did you get my $20 introduction? Did you hear that?
No, I'm afraid I missed everything but the last nickel.
Jeez. Well, I'm going to write it off at the end of the year anyhow because it's a business expense. Trust me, I took good care of you.
Well, I appreciate it.
All right. Now, we have the last time I looked at the global stove we're all sitting on, there were at least four kettles of thermonuclear soup now on the hot plate. I don't know, none of them are all necessarily on full boil yet, but they're certainly on simmer. We've got, of course, the kettle and the primary ingredients, North Korea and our car-collecting buddy, South Korea, and the United States, stirred in there and kind of swimming around. I'd say that's on medium heat. Then we have the other kettle next door on the Asian side of the range with China, Taiwan, and U.S. as the primary ingredients of that one. That's got to be on medium heat, low to medium. And then we go a little further around the globe, we find the India-Pakistan pot. That's on low heat right now. But the ingredients are there nonetheless. It is on, and it is warm. It's at least room temperature. And you never know, there's hope, could be hotter tomorrow. But then the biggest pot of all, of course, is the Middle Eastern kettle. That's on medium-high. The primary ingredients are Israel, with the exotic seasonings of Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Saudi Arabia, and forgive me if I left out half a dozen of the smaller Arab nations around there, but you get the idea. Israel, by the way, now qualifies as within the top five world suppliers of arms and armaments to all of those around the world who seek to kill their fellow human beings. So the myth of poor little vulnerable Israel, I think, needs to be retired once and for all. Okay, Charlie, that's my 2.5 cents. Where do you want to start? We've got four pots to look into.
Well, you know, we can work our way back from the matzo balls and the rice-a-roni and bring it around.
Let's do it.
For example, Israel. Israel has been, for the last 20 years, a major arms supplier to the world. One of their biggest customers, believe it or not, is China. In fact, if you look very carefully, the EP3 incident where their fighter plane bumped into our lumbering reconnaissance aircraft, if you look carefully at the video, you'll actually see Israeli-made air-to-air missiles arming the Chinese aircraft.
Kind of makes you feel warm and fuzzy, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, some of the technology that was provided to Israel in the form of the Sidewinders and the form of anti-radiation missile systems, things like that, has found its way into their industry. And, of course, that industry has seen fit to spread and sell around the world. The Israelis make no bones about it. They are very much in favor of selling to our pals in Beijing. In fact, they wanted to sell, I think, about $5 billion worth of radar aircraft that are known as the Falcons.
Yes, yes.
Phalcon. We objected. It was rather interesting. The sale was going to go through until yours truly wrote a piece on it, took the facts to our friends in Congress and noted that much of the technology was American. And then all of a sudden the deal went south. At this point, it appears with the approval of Washington, Israel is looking to their second best customer in Asia, and that be India.
Now, Charlie, I salute you for that. You know, these imbeciles in the Congress, they wouldn't know a bad arms deal like that if it walked up and bit them in their wallets, which are always bulging with cash from them. all those lobbyists and so forth. Anyway, this issue of Israel selling, now they're within the top five. In fact, they're right behind the U.S. according to one aspect of this survey. They sell so much technology that has been, shall we politely call it, jointly or co-developed with the United States. We built one half of their anti-missile system called the Arrow. All of us listening did, American taxpayers. The joint venture issue has been historic. It's a real problem, especially when it starts to be sold to our sworn enemies. And again, as you said, Charlie, Israel makes no bones about it, but in point of fact, if those weapons get used, they'll make lots of bones about it. It's a real problem. I call it treasonous, traitorous, treacherous, backstabbing, and a few other words we'll leave off the table right now. It's despicable is what it is.
Well,
here we are supporting this country.
From this point of view, Israel is not out for the national interest of the United States.
Thank you very much for that. Thank you. We've given them over $1 trillion at least in total aid, and much of that money, friends, has been used to kill other people, to sell materials.
We can go to two basic examples, the Lavi joint fighter project with the United States,
right,
which was eventually canceled,
yep,
because it was way too expensive, has found itself a new home in the form of the Shenzhou J-10 jet fighter.
Uh-huh.
A large number of the engineers and the design and the system from Israel left the Lavi project and went to work for Beijing. Thank you very much for hard, cold cash.
Yeah.
In the Arrow system, on the other hand, we've actually paid, I believe, about 60% of the total cost.
Makes me feel good every night when I go to sleep knowing I've contributed to that program.
Yeah, well, the flip side of this is that the Arrow is actually being used currently as leverage in the India-Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we have had discussions with New Delhi and with Israel over the sale of a Green Pine radar and some of the Arrow anti-ballistic missile systems to India. And this seems to be a very nice match out to counter the offensive missile systems being moved into play in Pakistan. So there's good news and bad news, but either way, you and I have already paid for it one way or the other.
And we also need to toss in here the small little asterisk, which points down to the bottom of the page, which makes mention of the fact that every single loan that we have ever given the state of Israel, not one penny of it has been paid back. Those are called loan guarantees. And what does Congress do every time they're due or every time a new loan program comes up? They write it off. Those are not loans, friends. They're gifts.
Well, there's no question that Israel and Egypt are the two largest benefactors of American foreign aid. You're looking at somewhere between $6 and $7 billion a year in outright grants, loans, money just given directly. The Israelis, in fact, have first choice of any weapon systems in our inventory to which they would like to either purchase or acquire. And, once again, a good example would be the purchase of F-15 and F-16 fighter planes.
Well, they just got the new
my tax dollars.
That's right. They're just
buying them.
Well, they just took delivery of their first four or five of the F-16-1 or whatever the new model designation is on it. They're getting those. Those are the most advanced F-16.
Yeah, this is the F-16I.
The I model.
The basic equivalent of what we call the Mod 50. This thing has extended fuel tanks, special air-to-ground delivery, computers, infrared systems, radar technology. All in all, it's a superior aircraft to even the ones that we're currently flying in the U.S. Air Force.
Well, they need the best against those Palestinians on the West Bank, so I'm glad that they got it. That makes me
feel
good.
You got to have the best to knock out a Mercedes.
Okay. Charles R. Smith is here, and I like the way Charlie does his analysis. His website is well worth visiting. Please click on his name and go there, softwar.net. We'll be right back as we continue to survey the top of the global stove we're all sitting on. You there, Charlie? Hey, Charlie.
Can you hear me now?
I do. You know what? See what happens when you criticize the wrong people? Big blue flash of light across the sky, and everything dropped out here at the studio.
Well, I'm just kind of wondering if you heard, you know, either heard Charlton Heston's voice or the voice of Mel Brooks in the background.
I saw an image of Ariel Sharon's face for a moment in the clouds. All right, enough of this silliness, and I would that it were. Okay, we're back. Now, let's finish up. We've got a couple minutes here. One or two more comments about the Israeli Middle East kettle. I didn't mention Egypt intentionally on that. Egypt is not being singled out at the moment as an open and obvious target. But what are the potentials of Israel and Egypt all of a sudden finding themselves as unfriendly bedfellows, as they would say?
Well, Egypt is the bulwark, the one piece of the puzzle that has remained, at least in a steadfast, I'm not going to go to war camp after the experiences that they've had before. They've had the Americans between the two nations. We've been exercising with both militaries. We are in the Sinai still. You know, it would take a withdrawal of our support and services to do that. Of course, Mubarak himself is in a precarious position. You know, even today we saw where he fainted when he was making his own speech.
75 years old now, he's growing his son.
So, you got to figure there's got to be some other strong man to follow him up, because the street level feeling in Egypt is not all that heartwarming towards Israel.
No. In the Islamic element, the fundamentalists, of course, are a significant factor in that country. I'd hate to see the Giza Plateau start glowing green and turn to ash. But let's just hope that stays stable. Now, the drumbeat against Iran continues. Are they or aren't they? Did they or didn't they? And did they take the inspectors to a dummy site, as some alleged Iranian exiles are saying, always suspicious? Who do you know to trust? How can you read these things anymore? Nothing is as it really seems, and I get the sense that most of these positions are either outright fraud or they're so corrupted that they're hardly worth paying much attention to.
Well, in the case of the Iranians, it's fairly obvious that developing nuclear power for electricity is a losing proposition. The Iranians currently burn more natural gas as a byproduct of just drilling than literally the rest of the world consumes in a year.
That much?
Oh, yes. The Iranians are sitting on a huge natural gas reserve. It would take absolutely no time whatsoever, as they have discovered, to divert that natural gas from some of the fields and pump it right into clean-burning power plants to supply them with enough electricity for the next 300 or 400 years.
Gotcha. Okay, all right, good. Now, why are the Russians going to build them 5 to 6 more nuclear reactors then?
Yeah, money. The Russians love the idea of having hard, cold cash. And you got to remember, the Iranians, because of their oil sales, have lots of hard, cold cash. So in order, of course, to understand the fundamentals here, Russia is the perfect place to go to, because the Russian nuclear reactor designs are antiquated, and therefore they also produce a very large amount of leftover plutonium, which, of course, could be useful for things like making a big green bang in the night.
Gotcha. Okay. Very good. Let's pause when we come back with Charles R. Smith. We'll take a look at India, Pakistan, and move on over to Taiwan, China, and U.S. Jack Kettle, and then we'll end up with our favorite on the Korean Peninsula, Charles R. Smith. Okay, a quick look at Pakistan, India. Now, many don't know that Pakistan wasn't even a nation until, what was it, 47? I can't remember, but something like that. It was part of India.
Yes, that is correct. And there actually used to be two parts to Pakistan. One part is now known as Bangladesh.
The toxic water capital of the world.
Right. Essentially, the Muslim and Hindu factions split after the British left, and the lines of demarcation were set down. We had East Pakistan, which became eventually Bangladesh, that's on one side. Then you have Pakistan proper, which is, you know, Islamabad and the other major cities on the along the western border of India, and of course you have India in between. There are plenty of disputed territories. Kashmir, of course, is the primary one that everyone is concerned about these days.
Okay, so the big showdown pretty much has been, it's a matter of history right now. Do you see it possibly ramping up anytime soon? Certainly both militaries are doing nothing but talking about matching each other's expansions and improvements and weapons systems additions. And they're not exactly pursuing a peaceful path.
There's not a lot of dialogue, which is a big problem. And, you know, even during the Cold War, even at the height of the Cold War, there was at least a hotline between Moscow and D.C. Between New Delhi and Islamabad, there is virtually no communications in many cases. And obviously, we're talking about a much shorter flight time here.
Yeah, like about 5 minutes.
literally from launch to impact.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, because of the nature of the targets, or the target cities that we're referring to, Delhi, Calcutta, Islamabad, Karachi, and others, the medical and other critical infrastructures are relatively weak.
Right.
And, you know, a fairly small nuclear device, like one that, say, detonated an equivalent of the Hiroshima bomb, around 20,000 kilotons,
right,
could cause as many as a million casualties simply because the medical, the sewer, the...
Right, not an impact. We're talking in the days and weeks subsequent.
Following, of course. Yeah, the basic infrastructure that goes with the cities and the civilization are very weak, and something like this could literally wreak havoc.
No, sure. Okay.
So what we have seen, though, is an exchange of tests. At least they're in the mode of warning each other prior to the test, which is, I guess, the good news. The Pakistanis test-fired a short-range, a medium-range, and a long-range ballistic missile. The short and medium ranges were of Chinese design. The long-range was a North Korean design, Nodong, which I believe they refer to as the Agari. The general, Musharraf, who runs the country, made a visit to South Korea recently where he completely and thoroughly denied that they have ever received any military assistance from North Korea. This was, of course, within a week after launching an exact duplicate of the North Korean Nodong missile.
Well, the exchange between Pakistan and North Korea, nuclear for missile technology, is pretty well known, and yeah, whatever. And like I say, everybody lies all the time.
Well, you know, in many cases, these kinds of lies are carried through in the form of economic and other international signed into treaties, which, you know, people will buy into basically,
sure,
because they get the money out of the deal and then try to ignore or cover up the actual truth of the events going on. Obviously, Pakistan is looking at South Korea as potentially a economic partner with investment and technology that they would like to share. Unfortunately, their record of dealing with North Korea, exchanging their nuclear expertise for the North Koreans' ballistic missile expertise, has pretty much put their policies, any sort of economic modernization with South Korea or Japan, on hold, because
mm-hmm.
both South Korea and Japan view the Pakistani overtures to North Korea as essentially a threat to their own national security.
So you got Pakistan, North Korea and China on one side, and then we have Russia, Israel, and India on the other side. That's how that axis lines up.
That is about how it lines up. Israel and Russia are the two of the main arms suppliers to India. Of course, the Israelis play both sides of the line. As you well know, they also supply a considerable amount of equipment and advanced technology to China.
All sides of the line.
Well, you know, again, this is the old Daddy Warbucks theme. If you can find a good market, let's exploit it. We, here in the United States, during the 1980s, during the Cold War, encouraged Israel to sell advanced technology to China as an effort to compensate for the Soviet Union. We didn't want the Chinese to get too weak
mm-hmm.
and become a tempting target for an expansionist Soviet Union. This is, you know, during the Afghan War. This was during, of course, during a time when the tensions between Beijing and Moscow were very high. There had been a couple of border skirmishes. The mobile ballistic missile force in Russia was pointed at China. So, you know, there was a potential for a big flare-up. I'm sure you remember, what was it, one of the early Patrick Swayze movies where he...
Oh, yeah. Red Dawn or something.
Right, Red Dawn, where he's a rebel leader here in the United States. Well, the gist of the war that had taken place was that the U.S. was attacked by the Soviet Union. At the same time, the Soviet Union also attacked China. So, again, when we run through all of these scenarios, it's kind of like 1984. We change sides, we exchange equipment, the balance of power starts to tilt one way or the other, and we change sides again. History, just like nature, abhors a vacuum, and the same thing in military technology. If you have a place that does not have a lot of military technology but has some money,
mm-hmm.
They're going to find a way to get to it. The Iraqis, the Iranians, the Libyans, all with their oil money, have long sought advanced technology from mainly the world powers.
Right. Okay, quickie as we go to the break. The IAEC says now that between 30 and 40 countries on the planet are capable of building atomic weapons right now. Russian Ministry of Defense chief said that Russia's military is not strong enough to fight a major offensive war now. Too weak. Could be just BS. Hard to know. It keeps going. And we'll be right back with Charlie. We'll keep...
The Chinese proliferation of nuclear weapons in North Korea and Pakistan, Taiwan and South Korea and Japan, our allies, who we had told many times do not develop nuclear weapons because that will have grave implications on our defense profile with you, are serious about developing their own deterrence, including nuclear weapons. I mean, you know, if you've watched Pakistan and North Korea, you fully understand what it means to have, you know, in the case of the Pakistanis, you had India as the primary threat. What has India done? They have responded with their own deterrent force. The net result is an uneasy balance. Obviously, we still are looking at a vacuum in the Asian theater with America being the only deterrent. And, you know, after the previous administration, Taipei, Tokyo, and Seoul don't necessarily look at Washington as the most faithful of allies. So it is no shocking surprise that all three countries are considering building their own nuclear weapons, as we predicted they would at the start of this when we had the North Koreans and the Pakistanis ignoring the proliferation cries, but of course the behest of Beijing. And, you know, again, the only people that really have themselves to blame for this is the war party in China, the PLA, and many of the members of the Central Communist Party, feel that it is their right to have their client states nuclear armed. And not so on the other side. And of course, this is a tactical matter.
Sure.
So, you know, don't be too surprised if we see Tokyo, Seoul, and Taipei all decide to go nuke. And as far as I'm concerned, and this is something that I think is being stated at the highest levels here in D.C., is if they do decide to go nuclear, if they do drop out of the non-proliferation pacts, that we not penalize them in accordance with the same kind of policy that we've been witnessing from Beijing. Technically speaking, once they drop out, you know, a number of economic sanctions get kicked in. Not a wise thing at this point. So Taiwan and China, believe it or not, are currently fighting a sort of a background war. It's not being publicized.
Hmm.
Taiwan lost, for example, with Liberia. If you recall, Liberia had their revolution, and the UN peacekeeping troops went in to take over for us Americans. Well, Beijing told the new Liberian government, either you de-recognize Taiwan as a country, or we will veto that peacekeeping force. So the Liberian government has de-recognized Taiwan as a country and moved their diplomats out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, things are tit for tat. The little island nation of Kiribati, better known as Tarawa, a scene of a very bloody battle in World War II, has decided to recognize Taiwan as a national government.
And the only problem with that is the Chinese have a very sensitive and very important radar and listening installation built there, which, according to the Chinese, is just for watching their own space program. But
yeah,
the antennas are all pointed
the wrong way. Miles south of the Kwajalein Atolls.
That's right.
Where we are currently doing our anti-ballistic missile testing.
And that's where all their antennas are pointed. The antennas are pointed at our stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, once again, it certainly is just a coincidence that they have very sophisticated listening devices for monitoring our ABM tests that are ongoing just a couple hundred miles north.
Which are actually, from my perspective, ludicrous in the extreme. And the only hit, in quotes, that they've had was on an incoming warhead which had a raging transponder telling everyone where it was so the incoming anti-missile warhead could intercept it. Ah, come on. And this is after how many years and how many hundreds of billions?
Well,
or whatever.
You know, the standard PAC-3, excuse me, not the PAC-3, the standard MOD-3, which is the Navy tests, have been extremely successful. I think they've only had one miss out of six.
Mm-hmm.
These are being fired by the USS Lake Erie. Keep in mind that because when we had the ABM treaty, we could not do these tests from our conventional warships. Now we can. And the extended SM-3s have turned out to be rather not only accurate, but let's put it this way, potent. And I think that's giving rise to a lot of thought here that if push comes to shove, all of a sudden some of our cruisers are going to appear off your coast, like the coast of North Korea or the coast of China.
I still want to know how those naval ships are going to fare against supersonic cruise missiles flying at 30 or 40 feet off the ocean floor.
Well, you know, once again, the here's how the tit for tat works for this. The Sunburns are currently mounted on the Sovremny class destroyers, of which there's only two in Chinese hands.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese are playing the old Soviet tactic. What they're doing is they're trying to station this destroyer as close as possible to their target. And the idea here is it's only going to get one shot, because if everything goes, if shooting starts, they want to get the first shot in, because otherwise they're sunk. The whole point of that is they got to identify which is our carrier and be able to get it in close enough. So don't be too surprised if those babies are probably being trailed by our friendly Los Angeles class attack submarines, of which we have somewhere around 45 or 50, much superior to anyone, including the Russian Aluka class subs. Our submarine fleet, I would say, are in this case our attack subs, are not only superior, on the war in the waters, but as one the bubblehead, as I like to affectionately call them, told me, is like, look, if the Chinese decide to step off on Taiwan, just ask yourself one basic question: how long can the Chinese army tread water?
Good question. All right, let's visit our car collecting friend with the pompadour. Kim Jong-il.
Oh, Kim baby. Well, hey, you know, he's been a busy little beaver these past couple of months, you know. He's got this new Soviet design missile. It's a variant off a Soviet submarine launch system. It does burn what's referred to as a hypergolic fuel, meaning that all you have to do is mix the two chemicals together and they ignite. You don't have to set a fire to them. It is a much more advanced storable liquid system. This is the kind of thing that, you know, you can fuel the missile up with, put it in a cave and let it sit there for a few months.
Right.
And if you want to, then you roll it out and shoot it. Unlike the no-dong and the type of dong systems, which have to be fueled just prior to launch.
Mm-hmm.
So they have made some fairly good strides forward. Now, obviously, they had to get this design from somebody. It is a Russian design, but again, the word that I get is they acquired it from their pals in Beijing. Now, you know, the Chinese are playing a game here with the United States in these negotiations. They're saying, we'll be the good guy. We don't want a nuclear war on our border with the Chinese, you know, with the North Koreans. We don't want these refugees and things like that. Yet, when we go back and look at the technical terms of what's going on, military to military speaking, we see the North Korean military and the Chinese military are working kind of hand in hand. And a real good example is about 2 weeks ago, the Chinese launched a photographic imaging satellite, the FSW-18. This is, you know, your classic camera, film camera system. It takes the snaps. When they're finished, you run out of film. Then you return the film canister to Earth and develop them.
Mm-hmm.
The primary target, and this is based on the orbital inclination as well as the lowest pass point that this satellite had. You know, we're talking about basic mathematics and orbital mechanics here. The lowest point was right over the Korean Peninsula. Duh. Uh-huh. So I can tell you exactly what they're photographing. They're photographing the new military installations that we're setting up to put in, redeploy our new troop systems there, because you notice we pulled back from the border.
That's right.
And they're also photographing launch sites that the South Koreans are building for their own tactical missiles, the ATMS systems that they had purchased from us. Now, those photographs are not important to the Chinese Army by any means. However, they would certainly be, of interest to Kim. So I would not be too surprised that Kim Baby is not only looking at a couple of pinups of Britney, but he's also got a nice big pinup map of South Korea and his new installations and new missile launching sites so he can retarget his missiles.
I would say also that if there were a limited nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula, it would be a great laboratory for the powers that be to observe and test out weapons that go beyond the normative use of weapons.
Well, you know, one of the things I think that makes the whole world nervous, or at least a good portion of the important part, is Tokyo. They're not all that far away, and they certainly are within breathing distance.
Well, Brittany makes me nervous. She's in the UK today, and in England, pronounced herself a role model for our young people today.
Oh, okay, and Michael Jackson is a role model, too.
Exactly. Well, that's a good analogy. Listen, they're not too far off.
Well, you know, artists being what they are.
The artists.
So, you know, Kim Jong-il was a role model for global dictators. You know, let's kill some people. Let's, you know, lock a few away.
I still say if he's gonna roll into the South, he's going to have to do it pretty soon.
There's no doubt about that.
All right. Thanks, Charlie. Great to talk with you. We'll look forward to it next month.
All right. Thank you.
Take care. Charles R. Smith, his website available by clicking on his name, or just remember softwar.net. We'll pause and be back.